Coming up, the blood and tissue samples used in research. Should the donors have the right to decide how their specimens are used? If the research leads to profit, should the donors be paid? And a Zen Buddhist priest teaching people of various backgrounds how to meditate. He says there's no conflict with religious beliefs.
Buddhism in general is not committed to God or no God. It's committed to awakening.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As President Obama chose General David Petraeus to be the new commander in Afghanistan, he insisted that the current counterinsurgency policy there would stand. Nevertheless, debate continued both about how to fight terrorism on the ground and about how to do that without weakening constitutional rights here at home. On Monday, the Supreme Court upheld a 1996 anti-terrorism law that bans what's called material support of any kind to a group that's been designated a terrorist organization. The law applies not just to giving money, but to giving advice as well. Civil rights organizations and humanitarian aid groups say the law infringes on free speech and could hinder peacemaking. We spoke with George Lopez, a Notre Dame professor and a visiting fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
We had always thought that you could talk with groups that were serious about wanting training in peacekeeping, wanted training in how to come to the bargaining table, and who wanted to explore solutions that were nonviolent. But the court's ruling is very, very clear that this constitutes material support. It makes it almost impossible to call together groups to help them turn in weapons, to turn over a new leaf, to engage in dialogue with the government. And that's a serious constraint, not only on the peace process, but on the groups themselves, obviously.
In the court case, two Jewish organizations, the Anti-Defamation League and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, filed briefs in support of the government's position. Muslim organizations are calling for more clarification of the country's anti-terrorism laws, which they say have targeted American Muslim donors and legitimate Muslim charities. In Pakistan, five American Muslims were convicted on terror charges for plotting attacks in that country and planning to wage war against Pakistan's allies, mainly Afghanistan and the United States. The five were sentenced to 10 years in prison. They were from the Washington, D.C. area and worshipped at a mosque in Northern Virginia. And in New York City, a guilty plea this week from the man arrested for the attempted Times Square bombing in May. During a court appearance, Faisal Shahzad referred to himself as a Muslim soldier. He said he was trying to retaliate for U.S. attacks on Muslims. Faith-based groups say despair is rising along the Gulf Coast as local residents cope with the devastating oil spill. Churches and other religious groups are providing emotional and spiritual counseling to those who have lost their livelihoods. Counselors fear a new wave of alcohol and drug abuse and suicides. Meanwhile, four Gulf Coast governors declared Sunday a day of prayer for an end to the crisis. Religious conservatives are protesting a decision by the Labor Department that allows all gay and lesbian parents to take leave for the birth, adoption, or care of a child. Meanwhile, President Obama met this week at the White House with prominent gay rights activists. He spoke of his commitment to equality and reiterated his desire to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, which defines marriage under federal law as between a man and a woman. This weekend, President Obama joins leaders of the world's richest nations in Canada for a global economic summit, and religious groups are urging that help for the poor be high on the agenda. The Jubilee USA network of 75 religious groups said the international leaders have made, quote, shockingly little progress in addressing global poverty since their last meeting 9 months ago. The network urged the summit to forgive more debts of poor nations and to fulfill previous promises of financial help. We have a story today about the samples of blood and tissue that medical researchers collect. They can help scientists find cures for diseases, but they also raise ethics questions and provoke bitter lawsuits. Should the donors set limits on how their specimens can be used? What about their and their family's privacy? And if the research proves profitable, should the donors share in the rewards? Lucky Severson presents Two Cases.
A bittersweet moment for members of the Havasupai tribe retrieving blood samples they gave to Arizona State University 20 years ago.
We felt very strongly that blood samples are sacred to all Native Americans, a major part of our spiritual, cultural, and religious identity. We are going to take them back down to Supai Canyon, where they can finally rest in peace.
Supai Village is actually at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, where about 600 Havasupai continue to weave baskets and farm and struggle against the diabetes that has afflicted so many of their tribe.
I began to see the sickness come to my elders. Some of my elders didn't have no legs. They would help us.
So the Havasupai tribe approached a scientist at ASU who took blood samples of about 200 tribal members.
32 people had passed on since this whole thing began. And it hurts. It hurts a lot to me.
Scientists at ASU could not find the link to congenital diabetes, but author Rebecca Skloot says they didn't stop there.
Those samples were later used without the tribe's knowledge for research into schizophrenia, alcoholism, the effects of intermarriage, and a lot of this stuff was stuff that they either found to be stigmatizing or that actually went against some of their own belief systems.
The Havasupai received a cash settlement, a rare win for cell donors. There are hundreds of millions of bio samples, such as blood and tissue, stored in bio banks in this country. But the answers to the tough religious and ethical questions about informed consent and compensation haven't kept up with the science. Bioethicist Jonathan Moreno says even the science fiction writers underestimated the state of the art as it is today.
You know, our science fiction writers anticipated, like H.G. Wells, the end of the War of the Worlds, the importance of bacteria in the late 19th century. People were really taken by that. But the science fiction writers didn't anticipate that our cells themselves would be the subjects of experiments.
And nowhere is there a better example of the importance of human cells than those cancer cells taken by doctors in 1951 from Henrietta Lacks as she lay dying of cervical cancer.
They are the most prolific cells. Nobody knows exactly why. They have some characteristics that have been identified. But they don't seem to age in every passage. So far as we know, those cells really are immortal.
Henrietta's cells grew sort of unlike anything anyone had seen. They double their numbers every 24 hours.
Rebecca Skloot wrote the best-selling book called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. She says Henrietta's cells, also known as HeLa cells, put end to end, would wrap around the Earth three times and weigh more than 50 million metric tons. But what's most amazing is their contribution to medical science.
And they have probably saved millions of lives, and pretty much everybody out there has benefited in some way from research on her cells. They were used to develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Her cells were the first ever cloned.
Henrietta's cells also made many scientists and entrepreneurs rich.
Her family, to this day, lives in quite a bit of poverty. They can't afford health insurance. So, you know, the scientists would come to get samples from the family, and, you know, her sons would say things like, if our mother was so important to medicine, why can't we go to the doctor?
Maggie Little, director of the Kennedy Institute of Ethics, says the courts almost never side with individuals whose biosamples become commercially profitable.
In general, when courts have looked at somebody who gave a tissue sample and the pharmaceutical company later did find a commercial application for it, the courts ruled that the individual who gave the sample didn't have any intellectual property rights or any claim to profit sharing.
Rebecca Skloot spent 10 years researching and writing her book and eventually won the trust of Henrietta's daughter, Deborah, who didn't find out about her mom's amazing cells until researchers asked the family for samples 25 years after Henrietta died.
Deborah was a very deeply religious woman, and she very much believed her mother's soul was alive in these cells. And so the scientists would come to the house and take samples, and she would say things like, you know, can my mother rest in peace if you're sending these bits of her up to the moon and injecting them with chemicals? Can she feel that somewhere? Does she then get sick in the afterlife?
She became so distraught, worrying about her mother, Deborah's cousin Gary offered to perform a kind of exorcism.
He just stood up and put his hands on her head and started singing and praying and, saying, Lord, you've got to take the burden of the cells from this woman. She can't take it anymore. It was an enormous relief for her.
Today, there are laws requiring consent from people like Henrietta Lacks, but they apply only to research that is federally funded. And there aren't clear laws regarding stored tissues. Maggie Little says if someone's cells are used for specific research and end up being profitable, then the donor should be compensated.
Sometimes individuals have biologies that are specially interesting, and their version of a cancer cell or their version of a liver cell is of enormous commercial value. And then it does seem to me that fairness indicates a little bit of profit sharing.
And ethicists like Jonathan Moreno feel that privacy and confidentiality are absolutely essential to protect those who do give.
If you take some of my tissues, my cells, and do genetic analysis, you're learning not just about me, but in some measure, at least, you're learning about my relatives. So we have to be very sensitive to the prospects of stigmatization.
As for informed consent and defining exactly what the researcher is looking for,
what drives a scientist is the unexpected. And that's what you can't capture in informed consent. Probably the better model is the idea that really, if my cells are being taken as part of my therapy, and they might be useful in science, I should really gift them. I should give them away to the scientific community so that they can be used productively.
Deborah might have argued that the family should have received some remuneration for Henrietta's fertile cells, but she finally came to terms with her mom's legacy.
You know, she really came to believe that Henrietta was chosen as an angel to live on in these cells and take care of people. And, you know, if you look at the Bible, it says, you know, the Lord, believers will be granted immortal life, and you never know what form they'll come back in.
As for the Havasupai, they've taken their sacred blood samples back down to the canyon where the tribe says they can rest in peace. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Phoenix, Arizona.
In other news, in Rome this week, Vatican officials announced the discovery of the oldest known images of St. Andrew and St. John, two of Jesus's 12 disciples. The icons date back to the 4th century and were part of a larger fresco on the wall of a catacomb under a modern building. Art experts used a laser technique to remove layers of white calcium that had covered the images. 4th century depictions of the apostles Peter and Paul were also part of the fresco. We have a profile today of the highly respected teacher of Zen Buddhism, Norman Fisher, in California. He's a former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, and he spends much of his time teaching meditation practice to people of all religious traditions and none. Fisher insists there's no conflict between Buddhist techniques and religious beliefs. Indeed, as Kate Olson reports, Fisher says learning to be attentive every moment can help everyone.
It's early morning along the Pacific coast. Norman Fisher, a Buddhist priest who's been teaching meditation for over 3 decades, opens a day of silent meditation for practitioners of Zen Buddhism.
Thank you all for coming, and I hope that everybody has a good day, a peaceful day, a day in which whatever needs to arise in your heart will do so.
Other days, Fisher is at Google in Silicon Valley, offering the same meditation practice to employees participating in a class called Search Inside Yourself.
Lengthen the spine, open the chest, and let your body hold itself up.
Or he may be at a Jewish contemplative retreat, sharing the practice with Jews seeking to experience their own faith tradition more deeply.
The practice that we're doing on our cushions is fundamentally the practice of just feeling our life.
The various hats that Fisher wears are part of his effort to help enrich everyday life experience by sharing the spirit and practice of Zen with the world.
If you really do the meditation practice and you continue that over time, your life really changes. You know, you really have a sense of purpose. You really have a much greater sense of connection to other people and loving kindness and interest in others and wanting to help others. Nothing makes us feel better about our own lives than that.
At Google, Fisher is helping employees increase their so-called emotional intelligence on the job. Since the class began just over 2 years ago, close to 600 employees have taken it, with the full blessing of management.
At Google, it's very explicit. Our brief is, let's get smarter about our feelings and emotions. Let's go deeper than we usually go for the purpose of getting closer to ourselves and being able to be more empathetic and more understanding of others. And that's the whole realm of emotional intelligence. There is no better technique or practice for going into and working through and really understanding our heart and the hearts of others than meditation practice.
Developing emotional intelligence is not a cognitive process, Fisher says. Understanding the heart calls for another way.
And this doesn't work by thought and will. It doesn't disregard thought and will, but thought and will are not the engine that makes this go. The engine that makes this go is taking a step back and trusting the body, trusting the breath, trusting the heart. We're living our lives madly trying to hold on to everything. And it looks like it might work for a while, but in the end it always fails. And it never was working. And the way to be happy, the way to be loving, the way to be free is to really be willing to let go of everything on every occasion, or at least to make that effort. So the practice really works with sitting down, returning awareness to the body, returning awareness to the breath. Usually involves, you know, sitting up straight and opening up the body and lifting the body so that the breath can be unrestrained. And then returning the mind to the present moment of being alive, which is anchored in the breath and the body. Then, of course, other things happen. You have thoughts, you have feelings, you might have a pain, an ache, visions, memories, reflections, all these things arise. But instead of applying yourself to them and getting entangled in them, you just bear witness to it, let it go, and come back to the breathing in the body. And what happens is you release a whole lot of stuff in yourself. A whole new process comes into being that would not have been there if you were always fixing and choosing and doing and making. This way, you're allowing something to take place within your heart.
Fisher says the meditation practice, which includes meditative walking, is not an escape from difficult or painful emotions and negative thoughts, but a way to be present and not attached to whatever arises. This opens a whole new way of seeing oneself and others.
I begin to notice others are rather like me, and I'm rather like them. There's not so much difference. You know, I'm scared. Well, probably they are too. I have yearnings or longings, well, maybe they do too. So maybe there's more of a sense of, a felt sense, not a theoretical sense, but a felt sense of actual kinship.
And this has implications that go beyond working more effectively for a company.
You end up coming to a place where it becomes more and more difficult to be harmful to others. It becomes more and more difficult not to be kind, more and more difficult to push for a result and not notice the consequences.
At the Jewish retreat, Fisher teaches meditation to help Jews experience their own faith more deeply. He draws on traditional Jewish language and imagery in his teaching, such as Jacob's ladder.
A ladder rooted in the earth and stretching up toward heaven. That's the human body, that's the spine, is that ladder.
Fisher, who is a practicing Jew, feels much of the teaching about Judaism today doesn't do enough to support a personal connection with God. Meditation not only deepens this relationship, but helps one see God in everything, as he says the Torah teaches.
When we sit, we recognize the crucial divine importance of absolutely everything that arises, every thought, every feeling, every breath, every unspeakable, unnameable impulse. But also, we recognize the ultimate importance of the others, of the sky, of all the sounds inside and outside the room. As the mind becomes a little more quiet, the sacredness of everything within and without becomes clear to us.
So how can a practice from Zen Buddhism, a tradition that does not speak of God, help practitioners from a tradition where God is central?
Buddhism in general is not committed to God or no God. It's committed to awakening. So taking this practice from Buddhism and applying it to Judaism, it's a way to go deeper into our heart, our mind, our consciousness. And in a Jewish context, when you do that, I think at the bottom, you find the divine, you find God. And there's nothing in this practice, nor is there anything in Buddhist or Zen thought that would deny this possibility.
Fisher, who has served as abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, says it's important on the spiritual journey not to ignore the emotional realm, which is sometimes overlooked in religious practice.
When we think we're going to go from everyday life straight through to the divine, leaving out maybe all the many needs and feelings and human foibles and frailties that are actually there, they need to be processed and dealt with. The thing about this practice that is, to me anyway, so sweet is that we're doing it together. We're walking in the big long line all together, like one person walking.
Wherever Fisher teaches, he says the practice is an ongoing contemplation that leads beyond the self to a deep connection and compassion for others and all life.
And if you stay with this practice long enough, you basically will work through all the knots and confusions that your life have sort of set up within you. The practice will help you work through that and see below, 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 below all of that to the place where you see what's really important to you and what really matters to you is that you are alive and you are alive in a world with others. You really feel like my life is a life of complete connection and it's a life of joyful connection and concerned connection, and then you have to act on that.
Fisher says the practice he teaches doesn't conflict with other faith traditions, but can be helpful to anyone on the spiritual journey, a journey he calls to the bottom of the heart. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Kate Olson in San Francisco.
On our calendar, Zoroastrians mark their Gambar Festival, celebrating the creation of water and the sowing of summer crops. Meanwhile, groups across the spiritual spectrum marked this past week's summer solstice. At Stonehenge in England, Druids, Wiccans, and others gathered for sunrise revelries. And in New York's Central Park, thousands of yoga practitioners kicked off the first day of summer at what they called the world's largest registered yoga class. Finally, there's a puzzling new poll out from the Pew Research Center. The questions were about what people expected to happen over the next 40 years. 58% said another world war was definite or probable. 53% said the same thing about a major terrorist attack on the U.S. with nuclear weapons. and 72% expected a major energy crisis. On the other hand, 64% said they're very or somewhat optimistic about life for themselves and their families. World war and optimism? As they say, go figure. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more of Kate Olson's interview with Norman Fisher about meditation. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. And you can always follow us on our Facebook page. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the Washington National Cathedral, where J. Magnus was consecrated last weekend as Episcopal Bishop for Federal Ministries, overseeing, among others, the denomination's military chaplains.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.